This is Mike Godsall, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 28th of January, 2013. Mike Godsall, Part 1.
My name is Michael Godsall, and I was born in Sevenoaks in Kent on the 19th of April, 1936.
So you're now
76.
76? Yeah. I was going to give you 10 years just then.
Well, somebody did the other day, actually. And it surprised me enormously.
would you say your father was an educated man?
Yes, I think so.
What was he doing?
He was a Lloyd's underwriter, but he was in the First War and was considerably older than my mother and died in 1947 at the age of 69. Yes, thereabouts.
So your education was, what was your education like then? He made a point of making sure you were well brought up, did he?
Oh, I think so, yes. I was the youngest of four, so I sort of followed in the tracks of the others, really, and went to prep school and public school. And
which one?
Eton.
Oh, yes, right, yeah. Yes.
And then did my national service in the army, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and then after that went up to Cambridge, and eventually, after 6 years, qualified as a veterinary surgeon there.
Do you remember what it was that made you want to be a vet?
Originally I was going to do estate management at Cambridge, and I got, with interviews and things, I got a place at Cambridge to read estate management. And then when I was about 17, I didn't think there was a suitable estate to run, and so I thought it would be sensible to become a veterinary surgeon, and I had a very good uncle who was a splendid chap who'd been an amateur jockey when he was young, and he was all for it, and he really sort of persuaded me that it really was a very good thing to be.
It's a very long training session, isn't it?
It's 6 years at Cambridge, but then you do a three-year degree, ordinary natural science degree on the way, which is a good thing to have done.
So what was your first inkling there might be somewhere on this planet called the Antarctic?
I've always been interested in slightly faraway things, and very much a country lover anyway, and not that there's much country down there, but at least it's uninhabited and unexplored, or relatively so. So it's always slightly appealed to me, and Scott, of course, I was always interested in as a schoolboy. And when I heard at Cambridge, one of the advantages of being in your final year is that at the end of lectures you hear about odd jobs that are going. And I can't remember which lecturer it was, so there was a job going in the Antarctic, and so I immediately showed interest. And only three of us did. One was my chap I became a partner with, in practice with a long time, and the other one heard that the sea was likely to be rough off the tip of South America, and he gave up straight away. So that left two of us, and it wasn't really a contest, because the other chap was married anyway, and there was no question of him being allowed to go. And so there was me more or less appointed after a brief interview with
this what other people call Bill Sloman's milk round? Was he coming around the universities?
I honestly don't know. I think there'd always been a slight tie-up between the Scott Polar Research and Cambridge University Veterinary School, and any sort of veterinary problems that happened down south, they referred to Tony Palmer, I think, who was a neurologist, but had obviously all the contacts and so on. And I think he was responsible for deciding it. And of course, Martin Holgate, the biologist, was very much in favour of sending a vet down when I went, mainly to put the dogs down, the old and decrepit ones and the ones that are no use any further, rather than the poor base people having to go out and shoot them in the back of the head, which is the way they'd always had to do it previously.
Let's come back in a little while. Let's see. Let's get there first.
Yes, all right.
We haven't got you past the equator yet.
Yeah.
The fact that the Spry and the college where you were learning to be a vet were next door to each other, was that instrumental, do you think?
Yes, I think it is. Yes, there's certainly a tie-up between one end of Cambridge and the other.
And did you apply to go south more or less straight away after qualification?
I got a job as a house surgeon at the vet school first, and the university were very generous and told me that I could take time off for as long as I was away and keep my job open, which was remarkably generous of them, actually, and I think probably wouldn't happen nowadays. But
do you remember the interview at all?
With Fuchs, yes, I do. And it was just a very pleasant chat, actually. And I don't remember anything testing at all. I mean, it was a very pleasant chat, and I was told that I'd be my main job would be to put dogs down, and would I be felt able to get on with the people who've been driving the dogs for years. And I said, well, you know, one does learn to get on with owners as well as the animals. And I didn't think it was going to be a problem, and subsequently it wasn't.
What did he make of Sir Vivian, or Vivian as he probably was then still?
Oh, an impressive character, without a shadow of doubt. But
how do you mean?
Sort of, I think probably more from what one learnt about him before you met him. But he was very pleasant, actually. I didn't have any hold-ups at all, actually. I thought he was very, you know, I went away thinking that we'd had a thoroughly enjoyable chat, anyway.
Were you not at all concerned by learning that the job was going to be largely euthanasia?
I know. It was largely exploratory anyway, because, you know, no vet had been down there before. And so, you know, I didn't know what I was going to find, but I had been told, Martin Holgate had said that there were dogs that were old and should be destroyed. Mm. And, you know, as far as disease or anything like that was concerned, I had no idea what I was going to find, which was all rather fun. And subsequently, it was quite interesting, actually.
So you hadn't specialised in dogs or even...
No, I'd done, as a house surgeon from between June and September, I'd done a lot of anaesthesia, which was the sort of house surgeon's job. I did anaesthetise everything. And so I did feel pretty confident about that. But I didn't have X-ray machines. I did write round to a lot of the drugs firms. I wrote Mayne, Baker and Glaxo and all the rest of it. Got an enormous quantity of drugs, which they gave you, which was terrific. I mean, but some of them were unlicensed and they wanted to hear how they worked. Mm. And this sort of thing, and some of them didn't work at all. And some, there's one particular sedative I remember, which was absolutely useless. No more sedated or husky than a bar of soap, really. But it was.
How much did you learn or realise at that time about what led up to the first vet being appointed? Because the dogs have been used in the Antarctic for 20 odd years till a vet turned.
Indeed, up. Yes. I certainly knew that the dogs were a pretty fit load of dogs, and they from inquiries at Cambridge, and they'd had very few problems. There were one or two things they thought they had ringworm at one stage, but they were a remarkably fit lot of dogs considering the conditions they live in, and it was interesting to find. You know, they were so good, actually, in fit.
I was thinking also of the politics that got you down there. I mean, some years prior to your appointment, there had been a move by Raymond Priestley to... Or he had been approached, I think, perhaps, about sending a vet down south. It took nearly a decade for it to happen.
I don't think I was aware of that, actually. I didn't know. I thought always, you know, I assumed that Martin Holgate was more or less the instigator of it. Mm. But... I don't know.
Oh, well, I'll show you something later on.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
So how did he get south?
Went on the Shackleton, on the train, with, I think, so about three bits of luggage, and 8 months later came back with 17 separate pieces of luggage, and I had no idea how.
Well, some of it presumably was samples, was it?
Yeah, samples and bits and pieces. But and went off by train to Southampton, and got on the ship and saw... The new hut at Cygne was lying on the jetty, and the usual ructions with the stevedores who would refuse to lift this and or lift that. And a wonderful bit in the... I was given the hospital cabin because there wasn't a doctor on board. And it was a wonderful demarcation dispute. They wanted to put an electric cable through from one cabin through the hospital sort of consulting room bit into another. So they had to get the carpenter first to drill through the wooden panel. Then they had to get the metal worker to come and drill through the bulkhead Then the carpenter had to come back to get through the wood the other side. Then the decorator come back and touch up the... And it was unbelievable. But eventually we got off, you know, and it was... Shackleton was a lovely, happy ship, actually. It was great fun. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
So were you travelling with that the following year's FIDS?
Yes, yeah. Mm.
What did you make of BASS at that time? Was it a lean, efficient organisation?
I think it seemed to be pretty impressive, actually. It's, you know, mind you, I was brand new, and I suppose I was frightened of having an opinion other than being impressed, I think, really. No, it seemed to work pretty efficiently.
And, did you form friendships on the boat?
Yes, certainly. I'm Bob Burton, without a shadow of doubt, and I've still kept in touch with Christmas cards ever since with Bob, but don't see each other very often. But, there are many people I've got to know and, you know, fond of. But I'm not a great keeper up with people. My wife always tells me I should have kept up with my school and university friends much more than I have. But, it was a happy time on the ship. And we had things like the ship broke down, of course, having just been serviced before it left. Off the Cape Verde Islands, we were stuck with engine trouble for about 48 hours, I think. And shark fishing with a meat hook and exciting things like that. And of course, being signed on in the Merchant Navy, as we were, sort of shilling a week or whatever, we had to bump the decks with those holy stone things. And that kept us all amused and spraying each other's hoses and things in the tropics.
Were your medical skills called upon?
Very little. And I had to distribute salt tablets in the tropics to the engine room and so on. And one chap, actually, I can't remember his name, but he was... And I've never known anybody so seasick. And he never got off his bunk, I don't think, the whole way. I mean, right when as soon as we got to Montevideo, he flew home. He was terribly seasick, and we fed him on dry biscuits and sips of water the way down. It was really quite concerning, actually. I didn't know anybody who could stay sick for that long.
Mm-hmm.
But...
It's a fairly common problem on these trips south.
Mm.
Lots of people mention that.
Really?
Being sick all the way to...
All the way,
to Montevideo, yes. Or even beyond.
Mm.
What was Port Stanley like when he got there?
That, unbelievably backward. I mean, it was quite an eye-opener that anybody could, you know, have a sort of a series of corrugated iron roofs, and you know, it was just as ugly as one had heard. And it was, but in many ways, I mean, there again, wonderfully friendly people, because they hardly ever saw anybody. And I spent a long time in the Falklands, actually.
Well, the arrival of the ship must have been quite an event, I would have thought, was it?
Oh, yes, and there's great sort of shrieks and yells from people on the shore. And it was, you know, I think particularly the first ship down in the autumn, when, well, there's spring, but. It was they were a very entertaining lot.
Not only had there not been a vet in the Antarctic, they were fairly scarce on the Falklands, I believe.
There wasn't one there. So they had a very good agricultural chap who handled almost everything of a veterinary nature. And they didn't do any veterinary medicine. And 10% of their ewes died by falling in ditches. They didn't worry about that. That was considered to be a perfectly normal way of losing 10% of your flock, which I was absolutely amazed. And you know, they hardly treated anything. It was usually just had its throat cut if there's anything wrong with it.
Did you witness that?
Yes.
What's the story behind that?
I can't remember. There's one that had a lump on its jaw or something. I said I really didn't think it was going to do any good. So the shepherd chap, and they're very, very good at it, I mean, no doubt about it. And they know exactly what they're doing. And the sheep plainly didn't really feel or see much more than it would have done if it had been shot in the head, actually. Mm. And
it was dispatched with a knife.
Yeah, they knew exactly what they were doing. But this is like the halal, you know, people aren't exactly...
this suggests you've been taken on then as a vet, have you, in some capacity?
Well, we all had to go for an interview with the governor when we arrived, and I thought he was a nice chap, Edwin Arrowsmith, and I said, but, you know, I was going to be... I had the option of either going to South Georgia or staying in the Falklands, and I thought there was no point in me going to South Georgia, much as I'd like to at some stage, but there's nothing to do there from a veterinary point of view. So I said I'd stay in the Falklands, and I'd be quite prepared to work for nothing, because I was being paid by FIDS anyway. Mm-hmm. Provided, of course, if the government would pay my travelling expenses around the Falkland Islands. Of course, I had a wonderful deal, because there were one or two stations, sheep stations out in the camp who wanted me, and so I was flown out in the little beaver seaplane thing, and stayed with people all over the Falklands, actually, and it was both before I went to the south of the Antarctic and after.
I have to ask you about the governor's milk cow.
He had a very, probably the best Frisian cow on the islands, which supplied Government House with its milk, and it calved down and got, I think it was hypomagnesemia then, which was, it was down and shaking, and, you know, and I knew what it wanted. It wanted some MagSelf injected, and so I went to see the Dr. Slessor, who ran the hospital, and said, I want some MagSelf, please. And he said, oh, yes, it's fine. And he produced three vials of 25 ml, I think they were, little tiny things, which we're normally used to using about 400 cc's in a cow. But it miraculously got up anyway, and it was a satisfactory outcome.
And walked away.
And walked away, yes. Yeah.
I think there's a story about cats as well, isn't there?
There are one or two stories about cats, yes. I had quite a few cats to spay or castrate, and because there was nobody there, you know, they didn't do it. They all, you know, full tomcats roaming the streets of Port Stanley. And there was one that was just about died, and I put it down, and I hadn't killed it. It wasn't dying because of me, and although. And I don't know, one of the Falkland Islanders thought it would be a bit of a joke to put in somebody's fish trap. And and this wretched cat's body ended up all over the place. It ended up in different fish traps. And it was hilarious, actually. As the locals have having a great laugh about it. But not the sort of thing one would laugh about at all in this country, really. I mean, it's,
yeah. Ivor Morgan tipped me off about a... he was with you when he had to go and deal with a cat-ridden house.
Yes.
Catching a cat with a towel.
Oh, that's right, yes. She had nine cats, I think. And yes, he got rather scratched, I believe.
Ivor did?
Yes, yeah. Because they were fairly wild, to say the least, and she wanted them castrated or spayed. And one of them was fine, we spayed it. And the next one was as wild as a kite and did not take... at all kindly to be handled at all. And we wrapped it up in a towel, which is a sort of traditional way of holding a cat so that it can't scratch. And the cat won that particular... so I think we only managed to deal with three of them out of the nine. But,
well, if they weren't used to having vets in the Falklands, were they glad to see you or slightly suspicious? Or
I think they were... the farmers, I think... And the local population with the cats and the ponies and things were quite, I think, quite pleased and were very welcoming and so on. But they're very much used to getting on without. I mean, they're remarkably sensible about most things. Farmers were, they thought they could get on perfectly well without and had done for years. And, you know, why, you know, and I was actually a new graduate and I didn't. There wasn't an awful lot of grey hair about in those days. but they did have what I was very alarmed about. There was the incidence of hydatid disease.
In children?
Well, no. I did talk to Dr. Cecil about it and said, have they ever had any human cases? And he said that they had one girl a few years previously who had to be moved up to Montevideo to be operated on. Well, she was the first human case that they knew about. But there were the number of cysts in the sheep were unbelievable. It was certainly up to about 30-40% of all the sheep livers and lungs had hydatid cysts in. And I was alarmed about this to such an extent that I wrote a letter, and which I took to the colonial secretary, and I said the farmers must be told about this. And the letter was sent round to all the farms in Falklands, but I don't think they took much notice, I'm afraid.
Was there anything you could do practically? I mean,
yes, I
don't understand the disease.
And everywhere I went, all the stations I went to, I dosed the dogs and had the most alarming collection. And parasitologists dream from the other end of the dogs. But I mean, they had a most archaic system. The slaughterhouses were usually a hut on the beach, and the sheep were slaughtered, all the guts and the lungs and things were shoved out through a hole onto the beach, where there were dogs and seagulls and children. You know, it was, you know, and that should not be allowed to happen. I mean, that's the way the dogs get infested and then, or reinfected rather, and then they pass on the worm. And it was alarming. And actually, when I was back at Cambridge a long time later, I was run up by a young doctor who was doing a PhD in hydatid disease in the outlying countries, and one of which he included was the Falklands. So I'm afraid they didn't take too much notice of what I said at the time. But
And you were visiting the sheep stations because Arrowsmith sent you to do that?
No, they were. I had a sort of patch on the radio because I knew there was no competition.
Not the vet phone in.
And anybody who felt that they would be interested in having me rang in and went out to see them. And the very first place I went to was Port St. Carlos, where the Navy ships were anchored during the war.
So, in order to try and compete against this hydatid cyst problem, were you actually recommending animals be put down?
No. The most important thing is to worm dose the dogs.
Right.
If everybody could be persuaded to dose the dogs at the same time, you would get rid of the disease virtually. It's over a year or two anyway. And I left an enormous quantity of worm dose, you know, down there, which these drug firms have given me. And
when you came back a year later?
I came back after 4 months. I came back, and I think it was after I really left the drugs and the letter, I think, on my way out.
Back to Britain?
Yeah.
Okay. So you never quite found out what happened?
No. But I gathered from... and it's... An example of how backward they were. The agricultural advisor chap, who was a good man, actually, I got on well with him. He had said in a report to UK in 1954 that he was worried about hydatid cysts in all the sheep. And he was told by Dr. Sessor of the hospital to take it out because he didn't think the cysts were alive. Mm. Which is sad, actually.
Mm.
But,
okay. At what point did you move on then from the Falklands?
I spent about a month before I went south. Moved on down south in November, I think.
And where did you go first of all?
Left in Shackleton and to go to Deception. And after 3 days, we were fairly firmly stuck in the ice. And that's before Deception, And so John Biscoe came up behind us and we went alongside eventually. And I was moved over because I think the Shackleton's water tanks were freezing. So it had to turn back. And so I then got on the Biscoe and went to Deception. And then from there I went to Hope Bay. And then from Hope Bay to Sydney and Sydney back to Deception, I think. Then to Port La Croix for Christmas, I think it was, which was only, you know, a couple of days. Then down to Argentine Islands, then to Adelaide. Well, eventually to Adelaide and Stonington, and back to Adelaide, and back to I can't remember exactly where I did go off on that, and eventually back to Port Stanley.
It sounds like a very, very intensive 4 months.
It was, and it was wonderful. I mean, it was really great. I mean, I'm so lucky to have got that job. I mean, it was absolutely wonderful. And I met a lot of people, because I met the people going in and the chaps coming out. And I remember thinking how incredibly nice the people coming out are. And that they're always... It was a lesson for life, actually. They're great. They're always help. You could never carry anything without somebody coming to help you. Or, you know, they just sort of get on with everybody. And I thought, well, if 2 years down there does that for people, what a good thing. They're, you know, really nice, helpful, and, you know, great company, actually. You know, I was very impressed.
Are there any fits or characters you particularly remember that you've got fond memories of? Or?
I know. It's difficult to pick out any one, really. And certainly I remember Ivan Morgan. John Tate, I certainly remember. Mm. He was a diesel mech at Deception and became my sort of unofficial veterinary assistant, actually, and he helped me with the post-mortems and things to quite a large extent.
John Tate?
Tate. Noel Darnham, obviously, was a memorable chap who did all the... He was in charge of the dogs at Hope Bay and went on down to Adelaide, I think, after that. To Sonnington. Charlie Sparnes, I remember, who was a South African character, about 5'2". He kept us all amused. Charlie Lefevre, who came out from Sydney on the way back with some, who was a larger than life character.
You mentioned that you met Neil Orr, who passed away just recently.
Yes, Neil Orr, I went to see when he was a house surgeon or junior registrar at Richmond Hospital, I think it was, because I knew that he'd done quite a lot of work with the dogs. And he was very, very helpful, actually, about telling me about the diet and how, what he'd done and so on, and what I was to expect, really. Good man. Base leader as well as doctor. And,
So when you started to come face-to-face with the Huskies, what was your kind of plan?
Every time I went to base, we got out of the dog man and went round the dogs and discussed them and decided what ought to be done and what shouldn't be done, which ones had passed were working life, or which ones had had problems and so on. You know, first day, but discussion, really. And policies were made, which I didn't have a lot to say about which ones should go and which shouldn't, because that wasn't really my business. But Sydney, I mean, they had decided more or less that all the dogs should go, because they were only ever used... Well, you could hardly sledge at all at Sydney except for 1 month out of 12, because it was rock most of the time. And they were spanned out on rock, which was a pretty awful way of doing it. And
Why was rock so bad?
Well, it's sub-Antarctica, and it's not as cold as the other places. And it was a purely a biological station, and yes. They didn't really...
So why was it bad to span dogs on rock?
Oh, because it was uncomfortable.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's simple as that. not really comfortable for them at all.
So. There was something called Sydney Neck, I think, wasn't there?
It rings a bell.
Did you find the dogs? What condition did you find the dogs to be in?
Oh, they were pretty poor at Sydney. They were pretty scruffy and thin and, you know, not a typical healthy dog by any means. And the people there weren't terribly interested in them. Mm. It wasn't a sort of high priority at all. They were very busy doing lots of other things there as well, as you know. But dogs didn't feature as a. They had a cat there, which I was. They tried to persuade me to put it down, and eventually we decided we should ship it out to Port Stanley, which I think eventually they did. But the captains of both the ships were not at all keen on having a cat on board, I gathered. So I left them to that, and eventually I think they got it persuaded somebody to take it back to Stanley. But,
was there any resistance to your arrival? Because presumably the Fids knew why you were there and knew what you were going to do.
I may be thick-skinned, but I wasn't aware of it if there was. And no, I don't think there was, actually. I didn't have any sort of embarrassments that I was aware of.
So what was the procedure then? How did you go about culling the dogs?
Selected a suitable shed, and with John Tate's help, usually, put them down with an injection, sedated them first, and then put them down with an injection. And it started off doing one or two a day, and then got a bit slicker at it and ended up doing about four a day, which was quite hard work. And I did full postmortems. I looked through all the organs, and particularly the joints were the things I found that sure interested me most. They all just... a large proportion of the shoulders, joints and hips had arthritis to a marked extent, actually. And, it was fairly easy to assume, I think, that it was because they pulled heavy weights on it. It was obviously stressing the joints, and I think it probably was. Later on, we had Andrew Bellis and I had quite an argument with the veterinary profession, and or some of it, who had come up with a hip dysplasia scheme, and they said it was almost certainly hip dysplasia in the Huskies. It was hereditary, and you know. But they never really answered the point that the shoulder joints were affected just as much as the hips. And so I'm absolutely sure it wasn't hip dysplasia.
The Sydney dogs, I think, at that time, were they not kind of being pensioned off from elsewhere in the Antarctic?
They had moved... Yes, they did actually move some out. They had four puppies there. And I think two of them we moved out.
I was thinking of dogs being moved from having had an active working life elsewhere in the Antarctic. Did they not then, was not Deception and Sydney used as kind of final postings for dogs?
I don't know. It may have been.
Okay, no, I don't know either.
Yeah, no, I don't know.
I'm just, what doesn't quite add up is the idea that these dogs had arthritis, yet they were only being used 1 month in the year, which makes me think that they must have come from somewhere else. Whether they'd had a harder working life.
I honestly don't know too much about the movement between bases before I got there. Certainly when I was there, we moved all the dogs from Hope Bay. There were three teams, I think, were moved down on the Biscoe, which I was then on Shackleton, but they went down on the Biscoe and put off at Adelaide or Stonington, I can't remember which.
So the process of dispatching the dogs, did the other dogs get edgy?
Do you think they knew what was going on? I don't think they have that sort of reasoning.
Right.
I think that's true anywhere, actually. It's, you don't do it in front of the others, obviously, but I don't think there's any... I don't think they really notice anything. It's often in the eye of the beholder, I think.
Before you dispose of the carcasses, were you you say you were taking samples?
Yes, yes. All affected joints, I cut off bits and preserved them in formal saline and brought them all back. And when I was writing it all up, I sectioned the joints and did the histology.
Again,
and so
we'll come to that later in the interview. And the carcasses, how are they disposed of?
One wouldn't be allowed to say this nowadays, but there was usually a handy crevasse somewhere, and down they went.
Same as any other?
Absolutely, yes.
Gash.
Yeah. It's a horrifying thought that they have to bring everything out nowadays. There we are.
So having kind of sorted the problem at Sydney, they moved on to the next base?
Then, yes, we went up from Sydney to Hope Bay and didn't do any work there. Well, there was... there was one dog there which had entropion, which is interned eyelids, which I operated on later on when it was at, been moved down to one of the other bases, which...
So whilst you brought that one out, can we talk a bit about how you did that, what you did?
General anaesthetic, you just cut underneath the bottom lid, take out a sort of wedge-shaped bit, having judged carefully how much you should take, and stitch it up again, and it just turns them out. And it it did work very well, actually, on that dog. I heard later from Rod Corner that he'd take the stitches out, and it was looking good. So that was something.
And this condition is this a consequence of inbreeding?
Yeah, that is a hereditary condition. Yes, it is. So I left urgent instructions that that dog should not be bred from. Why it should turn up in one among so many is difficult to say, but it is a recessive gene, I think. Mm. So it's bad luck, probably. Otherwise, the Hope Bay dogs were a complete contrast to the Sydney dogs. I mean, they were beautifully fit. And of course, Noel Downham had been the dog man, so to say no more. And they were very well looked after.
So, and were there any indications that they also had arthritis? Or?
There were certainly some which he knew were old and, you know,
not pulling well. Yeah. Not pulling well.
Yeah. But it was something that he would notice probably more than I would. And because it was almost invariably, it was both sides, so they weren't actually lame. There was one dog called Garth, I think it was, Sydney, who was unbelievable, and he used to scream with pain when he was pulling, but he never stopped pulling. He's incredible. I don't know if you call it bravery or stupidity, but I mean, it was remarkable. And post-mortem, his joints were absolutely, I mean, riddled with arthritis. It must have been incredibly painful, but he never stopped pulling.
And so there was no policy then at that time for FIDS to retire dogs that seemed to be in pain?
Oh, I think, yes. And any that weren't actually pulling their weight, and they used to leave them behind or actually dispatch them, which is the way of doing it. Which,
Martin mentions Garth, Martin Holgate.
Yes.
At Sydney. I'll quote from Martin's notes. At Sydney, some of the dogs did exhibit traits that were frowned upon, especially the loose woolly coat, which made them prone to hold ice. A huge dog named Garth was an example. And I did wonder about the FIDS breeding program at that time, whether they had selected their matings carefully enough.
Mm. Quite possibly true. And I think, actually, of course, on occasions, it was the dogs that selected their mating programs rather than the FIDS.
But did the woolly coats bother you at all? Was that something I guess you were there in the summer, so perhaps you
were right. Yes, it wasn't so obvious then. But yes, it would bother me. I can understand it being a problem, actually.
And Martin does say here that, I wasn't making it up, Sydney were really, the dogs at Sydney were really reserve teams, sent there partly in case of need, but also, I suspect, as a retirement home to avoid having to put them down.
Fair enough.
So they were dogs that had worked elsewhere, and that's where they injuries had come from.
Yes.
Yeah. So then, so this was a kind of a pattern, really, of moving from base to base.
Yeah.
Giving the dogs a thorough checkup.
Yes. Yes.
And then making decisions.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Do you know how many dogs you did put down in the end?
36 huskies, 2 cats, and Peso, the old pet dog at Argentine. Which, was it Argentine or Adelaide? One of them.
I don't know.
Yeah, because okay. I was approached, and I couldn't remember doing that one. And somebody, I've got his name there, but I can't remember. He rang me up and said that had I any recollection of putting a pet dog down, and it must have been 45, 50 years ago, or 47 years ago, because it was only a few years ago, and I couldn't remember doing it. Anyway, I looked up my diaries and found that I had, and because he was doing some sort of history of the pet dog in Antarctica or something. I don't know what it was he was doing, but he wanted to know the details, and I had actually put this dog down.
Did it affect you at all? Mike, I mean, did it upset you that you were having to do such a lot of dog culling?
I think one, if you know, as a vet, you get, actually, I won't say used to it, but you know you're doing it, and it's no worse for the dog than a general anaesthetic. And, you know, you don't, And I got upset when two of the pups from Sydney had to be put down. There were four pups there, and there were two, you know, young pups. And that is a bit, you know, does seem rather a waste of life. But I mean, they moved two out, which went south, and two of them were, decided not to go. But, and you don't like doing that, obviously. But no, I think the actual, you know you're doing it without the animal either knowing about it or feeling anything, really.
And for good reason.
And for good reasons, yes. Yeah. Mm.
So all the time you're acquiring all these samples, this excess baggage. That's,
yes, indeed, yes.
Which you were carting around the Antarctic.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you make of the other bases you had to visit? I mean, do you have a particular fond memory of any particular one?
Argentine was, and it was a lovely place, and it was, and a nice place for, you know, but for the dogs to live and so on, and they were a good selection of very, you know, good healthy dogs. I didn't spend very long there. And Adelaide, I got to know more by repute than anything else, because then we were stuck off, you know, in the ice off Adelaide for a long time, and eventually anchored up on the ice cliff, and ferried things up to the Piedmont on the top, and then, of course, after an awful long time, the ice suddenly disappeared and we sailed around. So I was there quite a few days, but by then it was getting fairly late, and everybody was assuming we were either going to have to winter down there, or, you know, wonderful rumours on the ship, and we were going back by Punta Arenas, and we were going to Simonstown at one stage, you know. And we weren't going to go to Adelaide at all, was at one stage, and that would have been sad because I would have only seen half the number of dogs I eventually did see. But that was a strong rumour at one stage because we weren't going to get further south.
And Biscoe was stuck for quite a long time, wasn't it? 50 days or so?
Yes, it was about 55 days, I think, altogether, and with give or take a few miles here and there. But
how do you think you would have coped with a year in the Antarctic? Would it have been...
Oh, I would have loved it. No doubt at all. But I was very happy down there. I loved it. And not only, it's just the sort of sheer beauty and the peace and quiet, even when you were on your own, you know. No, I absolutely loved it. And the chaps down there were very good company too, actually. No, I was quite happy, but only, I was slightly concerned I had my place at Cambridge booked to go back to the job afterwards.
Yeah, but the Antarctic guy doesn't read your diary, does it?
Yeah.
So talk a bit more about the other bases you went to then, Argentine Island and Stonington in particular. What did you find when you went to those bases amongst the dog population?
Adelaide, the dogs were in super condition, and they were really working dogs, and they were very good indeed. And as indeed they were at Stonington, which ran a big sledging base, and that was a wonderful place to sledge from and so on, because it goes straight up onto the plateau. And Stonington, I was only there about 4 days, but it was memorable because I think three of the days it was cloudless skies, and it's absolutely beautiful, but around Millerant Bay with the reflection of the mountains and the water, it's stunning. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful, and I can remember that scenery as long as I live, I think. But the dogs were fine, and the ones who did the post-mortems there, we used the old American hut as a post-mortem room.
You did the PMs on, well, you took the samples on location.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm.
Did you ever see the dogs in action?
Yes. I went for a short trip with Noel, and that was one. And then we called in at Anvers Island, and John Cheek, I remember, and his team is called the Comats. I don't know why I remember his rather than anybody else's, but I do. And we saw him in action. But, you know, I would have loved to have been able to do more. But when you're calling at the base, it actually was quite busy because I'd not only got the post-mortems and things to do, but there was always the unloading, you know, endless amounts of outgas and food and goodness knows what.
Oh, you got caught up in the relief work, did
you? Oh, yes, certainly, yes, yeah.
That's perhaps Maybe that's why they chose to send the vets out. Yeah. Extra pair of hands at all the release.
Yeah.
But in each case, a pattern was that you would discuss with a doggy man what to do.
Yeah. Mm.
Did you give them the option of dispatching their own dogs?
No. I don't think they would have wanted to, actually, anyway. I think that was... They knew I was there for that job, I think, as much as anything else.
It was actually a relief to them not
to have to do it. Absolutely. It can't be much fun as if you've been driving a team for a couple of years, you know. I can't imagine anything... You build up quite a relationship, I'm sure. I've never had it personally, obviously I haven't, but, you know, your lead dog particularly must be... Mm. You know, it's your friend, isn't it, really? It's, it should be.
Mm.
I remember the one time that went with on the stage with Nell. His lead dog got thumped good and hard about three times, cause, and I wonder if he wasn't too friendly on that occasion. But no, I think it is a pretty special relationship.
Disciplining the dogs is always a slightly contentious issue, isn't it? Because the dog handler will tell you that they have to go in there and be firm, which is covers a multitude of sins.
Yes.
And using the thumper is pretty violent
thing
to do. And were you surprised at that the amount of aggression that
I was don't being think applied? I was surprised, actually. And they are very tough dogs, and they're not like pets. And although they're the Antarctic ones are very friendly. Over-friendly, that's where you're likely to get knocked over by them jumping up saying hello, you know. But when I was at Cambridge later on, I went up to the Arctic, to Labrador, and because it seemed a good idea to do some comparative work. And the Eskimo dogs are not at all the same character.
In what way?
And, well, they're not so friendly or domesticated. I mean, you wouldn't trust them anywhere near how you trust the Antarctic dogs. Because they were treated, I mean, the English dogs were treated by, you know, sort of English people who sort of have a much more of a friendly approach to dogs than ever the Eskimo does, because they used to, a lot of the Eskimos used to turn their dogs loose in the summer because they were no use and they'd have to feed for themselves. And, you know, they had just about 6 or 8 weeks before I got to Labrador, they'd had a child eaten by a pack of huskies. But it's not surprising if they've not fed. You know, you can't blame the dog, really.
This is a slight dog's leg, if you excuse the expression, but in the mid-90s, when it was decided that there should be no more dogs in the Antarctic,
yes.
I mean, they'd already been thinned out quite a lot by then, but the final dog run was, I think, 1994.
Yes.
And rather than have those dogs put down in the glare of publicity, Bass arranged to have them all transferred to Hudson Bay.
Yes.
Well, they didn't really thrive. In fact, they gradually popped their clogs one by one.
Yes.
Is that something you might have kind of imagined would happen? Is that, I mean, worked in both environments?
Something you might have feared would happen, I think, possibly. But it's like sort of going down to the Antarctic with a ship, with people with the common cold on the ship. Because I remember this happened at Deception when we arrived, so, you know, quite a lot of set of code which we brought from Sandy or something. And the chaps on the base were absolutely mortified by this, and they were crippled with because they were totally
germ-free.
Their immunity was nil against the common cold,
yeah.
And so they got it far worse than, sort of normal people do in a big population. And I rather think possibly the same might happen to the dogs when you bring them out from open to anything that they're likely to catch. I don't know. I mean, that's supposition.
So they would be vulnerable to disease.
Yeah.
But also vulnerable to a less caring environment if the northern dogs were being left to their own device in the summer, whereas in the Antarctic they were fed all the time.
Yes. Possible, I don't know. I mean, that is supposition. But sad that they did all eventually. You know,
three survived.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Which is not very many out of, I don't know, how many they brought out.
16, 18, that kind of, I'm not quite sure. You also did some positive medical work on a dog called, I don't know what it's called actually, coal. There's a bone stuck in it somewhere.
That's right, yes. That was Coal.
Coal?
Yeah. Who was a greedy dog at the best of times, and he got a lump of seal bone stuck in his small intestine. And it was fairly obvious he had, although I hadn't got an X-ray machine, he was vomiting one end and not passing anything the other, so you know there's something, there's a hold up somewhere in the middle. And he was a very relaxed dog, and you could feel with your fingers, and I knew perfectly well that's what it was, because I could feel his bone by palpating his sides. And I gave him a jolly good dose of liquid paraffin and one night, and said, if he hasn't done anything by the morning, well, have to open him up. And he did nothing overnight. And so,
No, number two.
This was on the Bisco, I think, at the time. And we cleaned out the, I think it was a cruise mess or something. It was, you know, not our end of the ship. But and Sandy Muir, who was a doctor, he was an anaesthetist, and he had ideas that he'd do the anaesthetics, and who was the other chap? Rice, I think, is another doctor, I think. Tim Rice, was it? So no. Anyway, I can't remember offhand. But they did the anaesthetic, and I opened him up. But being an anaesthetist, he thought he'd give him a pre-made of a bit of pethidine and just a smidgen of thiopentone. And maintain it with pethidine and ether, which was it seemed a very good idea. And he said he was an anaesthetist, so fine, he'd know what to do. And so he let him free with his jar of ether and with a mask, as was. And so the whole, in no time, it got into the air conditioning system on the ship. There's rather an embarrassing smell of ether around the ship, but it was nothing too serious.
And anyway, people weren't dropping.
No, nothing like that. But it was quite a noticeable smell. But anyway, the operation all went very well. Pulled out a little bit of bone, stitched him up, and he did very well indeed, actually. And then we just took out all the stitches after about 10 days, and he was fighting the neighbouring dog for a piece of seal meat and burst his stitches open again, so I had to stitch him up again under local anaesthetic that time, and just the skin that was. And then I had to move on from that particular bit, and I think we left him on the base then, because he was on the ship at the time. And I gathered that he's went on very well, and that was the end of that.
Again, were you called upon to do any human medicine?
Yes. Two occasions I had to assist at an anaesthetic. One was Ken Back, who had a dislocated his thumb, and Rod Corner said, would I be able to help with the anaesthetic? And actually, it was exactly the same anaesthetic machine, a little thing called a Fluotec, which I'd been using as a house surgeon at Cambridge, exactly the same machine, so I knew about how to, you know, turn that on and off and so on. And that was this wonderful kit they had down there for anaesthetising people in emergency, and it was detailed instructions about 3 breaths at such and such a thing, and then 5 breaths at another strength, and then you turn it up. And it was fine, it all worked very well, actually. And he came round and was perfectly happy, and his thumb had clicked back into place.
And the second one?
The second one was, now, oh gosh, am I going to forget his name? I could tell you if I look in my book, but I can't remember his name now. But he got his, it was done on the way back from, no, it was done further south anyway. We were in the scow and it was swinging about trying to get it back on the ship, on the Bisco, and he got his arm stuck between the cabin on the scow and the ship, and I thought for one ghastly moment he had crushed his chest, but it was he'd just broken his wrist. And there wasn't a doctor about at the time, and we thought we'd better try and get him back to, it must be in Adelaide, I think. And anyway, the ice thickened up again. And we were met by the Navy, the Royal Navy launch. And there's a doctor on that, so they came on board. And again, they said, could I help with the anaesthetic, which I did. And turned the dial thing. And poor old chap, I knew his name this morning.
We can look it up.
Yeah. Anyway, the anaesthetic was fine, and but it unfortunately set it about half an inch out. He had, when he got back to Port Stanley, he had to have it redone, which was sad. But so that's as far as I went with human anaesthetics. I think far enough, probably. But,
what were your impressions then on leaving the Antarctic? Were you sorry to have to go, or were you desperate to get away?
Sad to leave, certainly. Yeah, but as I said, the people coming out were so nice. Fred Gibbs, who had been the dog man at Adelaide, I think, and a most impressive chap actually, and a very likeable chap. And you know, we had a. And then, of course, I came back to the Falklands and had another month there, and which persuaded me to forget about the Antarctic for a month or so, and then came back on the Shackleton again, I think. I had a memory of only sort of moving ships initially and then ending up on the Biscay, but when I read my diary, I'd made backwards and forwards carrying all this kit from one ship to another. It's terrible how things disappear from
one's
memory. Over 49 years now.
Yes. Yeah. Let's just pause for a minute whilst I change my tape and my little disc. And then I've got a few more questions to ask you, if that's all right.
Yep.